Good to see all who've been able to come back and be with us this evening. As we look at the Sermon on the Mount, we see Jesus addressing some specific sins of the heart. He talks about how they, the religious leaders, the Pharisees, how they had set up some standards, how they had come up with their own parameters of how to properly keep God's law. And he exposes them in the first part of this sermon in Matthew chapter 5 for the hypocrites that they were. We're not going to be studying from the Sermon on the Mount, but the point that I'd like for us to see just briefly here is that though Jesus does talk about specific sins that were committed or would be committed, he points out how that with each of these, there's something behind it. There's something back of the sin that shows that the person's heart had departed from the Lord long before the actual committing of the sin ever took place. In verse 21 of Matthew chapter 5, he says, "You've heard that it was said to those of old, 'You shall not murder, and whoever murders will be in danger of judgment.'" So murder was a sin. God, in giving the Ten Commandments, made it clear that they were not to kill. Even going all the way back to Genesis chapter 9 and the things that the Lord told Noah after exiting the ark, if man shed blood by man's hand, should that one's blood be shed? And so from the very beginning, even really going back to chapter 4 with Cain and Abel, we see that killing, that murder, was an offense against God. But what Jesus shows here in the following verses is that the problem existed long before the murder whatever took place. And just because you didn't murder someone didn't mean that you weren't guilty of sin. To hate a brother without cause, Jesus said, would bring you into danger of judgment. In verse 27, you've heard that it was said, "You shall not commit adultery." Of course, adultery is a sin. Again, in the Ten Commandments, God made it very clear that they were not to commit adultery. He, in one of the other commands, says that you should not even covet your neighbor's wife. But here, Jesus goes back to show that before the adultery ever takes place, there's lust that occurs within the heart, and that is a sin that we need to be concerned about. And so without going through the entire chapter, I think we can clearly see that sometimes we can focus on some external, some specific action that, yes, God has condemned as sin, and we can completely ignore some underlying things that led up to the sin. That if we would learn to deal with these underlying problems, it will help us not to commit the sin. And it would also help us not to feel some sort of release or freedom from guilt if we don't commit some of these greater sins. We might consider some of these to be a greater sin, all the while committing what may be in our mind is a lesser sin, or maybe even no sin at all. That these are just thoughts, these are feelings. You know, though I'm not really acting on anything, so therefore it must not be wrong. I want to go back and look at some of Israel's history. If I were to just ask, if we were in a Bible class setting, what was the sin that Israel was guilty of that really led to their being removed from the promised land? What was the sin that Israel was guilty of that brought God's wrath down on them time and again? And I think a correct answer would be idolatry. Idolatry because of the influence of the nations around them, the influence of even the nations they had dwelt among earlier. Those influences had a lingering effect, and so idolatry was a problem. But I would like to go back and look at several passages and see that the idolatry wasn't necessarily the thing that they needed to be most concerned with from the beginning, that there was another problem that was in existence that had they dealt with it properly, perhaps the idolatry would have been avoided altogether. In the book of Exodus chapter 4, at the end of chapter 4, you have the Lord after commanding Moses to go and lead his people out of Israel. You have Moses and Aaron going and speaking to the children of Israel about what God's plans for them were. And so I'd like to pick up in Exodus 4, begin reading in verse 27. In verse 27, the Lord said to Aaron, "Go into the wilderness to meet Moses." So he went and met him on the mountain of God and kissed him. So Moses told Aaron all the words of the Lord who had sent him and all the signs which he had commanded him. Then Moses and Aaron went and gathered together all the elders of the children of Israel. And Aaron spoke all the words which the Lord had spoken to Moses. Then he did the signs in the sight of the people. So the people believed. And when they heard that the Lord had visited the children of Israel and that he had looked on their affliction, then they bowed their heads and worshiped. And here, the beginning of this story, the beginning of the exodus of God's people from their bondage, it starts out very promising. You've got a people who, in verse 31, believed when they heard that the Lord had seen their affliction, that he is now going to answer their cry, and in response to their belief, and they worship, they bow their heads and worship God. And what better response could you have? But now think about what they have heard. You know, here are a people who have been made to work with rigor. If you go back to chapter 1 and look at the oppression that they lived under with this Pharaoh who didn't remember Joseph or the good things that he had done for Egypt, even to the point of having their baby boys thrown into the river to be killed, it was a tough life. And now God has come down and said, "I'm going to deliver you from that. I'm going to take you out of that misery, and I'm going to deliver you to a promised land." Now, do you think that would be maybe hard to believe? You know, at first, maybe, you know, how's that going to happen? We've got two men here, Moses and Aaron. How are they going to defeat Pharaoh and his armies? But then after performing the signs that God had given them, now they have a little more hope of, well, maybe there is some power in these two men that can overcome what Pharaoh could do. And so they believe, and they have something to believe in, and they're excited about their future and what's going to come. But then chapter 5 happens. You have Moses and Aaron going to Pharaoh and saying that God has sent me to you to tell you to let my people go. And Pharaoh's question is, "Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice?" Well, as the story continues, Pharaoh's not content just to say no. He takes it as an affront that Moses and Aaron would even ask such a request, and he's going to take it out now on the Israelites. I think Pharaoh knew exactly what he was doing, not just making their lives more miserable for spite, but trying to drive a wedge between Moses and Aaron and these people. And he's effective in that when he makes their work even more difficult by withholding some of the straw, the things that they needed to make their quota of bricks every day, and still requiring that same quota. Well, the people are miserable. And in verse 20, after they come out, some of the leaders from speaking to Pharaoh, this is in Exodus 5, verse 20, they met Moses and Aaron, who stood there to meet them, and they said to them, "Let the Lord look on you and judge, because you have made us abhorrent in the sight of Pharaoh and in the sight of his servants, to put a sword in their hand to kill us." What happened from the end of chapter 4 to chapter 5, verse 21? Well, what happened was some adversity had come along, something that wasn't quite so pleasant. The news now is not as promising as what they thought when Moses and Aaron told them about their deliverance. And so they're upset. They want Moses and Aaron just to leave them alone, but thankfully they did not do that. They followed the Lord's commands. And just by the way, you know, there are times when people will respond to us like that. As we try to help, they just want us to leave them alone. They feel like we're making matters worse. But there are times when we just need to still continue to follow God's plan and listen to what He says. But if you fast forward in Exodus to chapter 12, you have again another very exciting time for these Israelites. After the 10th plague with the death of the firstborn, not only does Pharaoh say, okay, now you can go, he says, get out. He's going to drive them out of the land, but they're not going to leave empty-handed. If you read with me in Exodus chapter 12, beginning in verse 31, then he, that is Pharaoh, called for Moses and Aaron by night and said, rise, go out from among my people, both you and the children of Israel, and go, serve the Lord as you have said. Also, take your flocks and your herds, as you have said, and be gone, and bless me also. And the Egyptians urged the people that they might send them out of the land in haste, for they said, we shall all be dead. So the people took their dough before it was leavened, having their kneading bowls bound up in their clothes on their shoulders. Now the children of Israel had done according to the word of Moses, and they had asked from the Egyptians articles of silver, articles of gold, and clothing. And the Lord had given the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, so that they granted them what they requested. Thus they plundered the Egyptians. Then the children of Israel journeyed from Ramses to Succoth, about 600,000 men on foot besides children. And from that point we read about their going forth out of the land, headed toward the promised land. And they're not going empty-handed. They have their livestock, their herds, but then they also have the spoil, the plunder that they've taken from the Egyptians. And if you want to know just how much they have, when you get over to the building of the tabernacle and you look at the weight of the silver, the gold, the bronze, and the gemstones, and the fine linens, and you wonder, where did they get all of that stuff in the wilderness? Well, they took it from Egypt. The Lord blessed them. And so they went up, and again, now you can see they're willingly following Moses, because why not? Things are going great. This is what is best for us. And they can clearly see that now until you get to chapter 14. In chapter 14 and verse 10, after Pharaoh has changed his mind, he takes his army, he's going to go after the Israelites. And I'd like to pick up in verse 10, Exodus 14 and verse 10. When Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them. So they were very afraid, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. And they said to Moses, because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you so dealt with us to bring us up out of Egypt? Is this not the word which we told you in Egypt, saying, let us alone that we may serve the Egyptian, for it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than that we should die in the wilderness? Now, is that what they were saying back in chapter 12 when they had their gold and all of the costly gems, when they had the spoil? Is that what they were saying when they were leaving? No, but now that difficulty came along, now that they faced odds that they couldn't understand, they couldn't see how they're going to be able to overcome this, their minds go back to Egypt, and they're not willing to trust God. They're not willing to trust Moses and his leadership. And we're not going to continue in this story right now. I want us to fast forward quite a bit over to Numbers chapter 14. Of course, you know, they do cross the Red Sea. They see a mighty, wonderful work of God allowing them to cross over on dry ground. They're so excited in chapter 15. They sing this song. But then in the same chapter, they begin to complain and murmur once again. But we're going to fast forward really all the way to the beginning of the end for this group of people. You remember we read that it was a little over 600,000 men on foot who were leaving Exodus, or leaving Egypt. But Numbers 14, they're on the verge of taking the land. Everything's set in order. The first chapters of Numbers have everything, the ranks set. They're ready to march. They're ready to go in and conquer. But when those spies come back and they give that report that, you know, yes, the land is exactly what God said it would be. And here's even some evidence of the fruit that's there. Yet there are giants in the land. There are walled cities, fortified cities. And we are like grasshoppers in their sight. There's no way we can overtake it. Whereas Joshua and Caleb were not able to convince them otherwise. I'd like for you to look at what's said in chapter 14. When here they're still being pled with to listen to God, to trust God. Verse 6, Joshua the son of Nun and Caleb the son of Jephunneh, who were among those who had spied out the land, tore their clothes. They spoke to all the congregation of the children of Israel, saying, "The land we passed through to spy out is an exceedingly good land. If the Lord delights in us, He will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land which flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against the Lord, nor fear the people of the land, for they are our bread. Their protection has departed from them, and the Lord is with us. Do not fear them." The call there in verse 9, only do not rebel against the Lord. That's the very thing that we've been seeing from almost the very beginning when Moses and Aaron tried to bring them out. They continually doubt the power of the Lord. They continue to want to just continue this existence of a life of bondage under the oppression of Pharaoh. Well, we know that they do rebel. And I want to fast forward now to Deuteronomy chapter 9. You know, here in Deuteronomy, Moses is talking to a new group. Just after where we're reading there in Numbers 14, the Lord curses all of that group, 20 and above, men who were able to go out to fight, to die in the wilderness. And Moses is now trying to prepare this new group to go in and do what their fathers had failed to do. And in Deuteronomy chapter 9 and verse 7, Moses says, "Remember, do not forget how you provoked the Lord your God to wrath in the wilderness. From the day that you departed from the land of Egypt until you came to this place, you have been rebellious against the Lord." Now, there are a lot of things we could go back and look at and see, you know, some specific sins of complaining and lack of faith and trust. But Moses here just sort of sums it up. From the day that you left until now, you have been a rebellious people. Drop on down, still in the same chapter, Deuteronomy 9. Drop down to verse 24. He says, "You have been rebellious against the Lord from the day that I knew you." From, again, that time that Moses came back and said, "Hey, this is what the Lord has planned for you." You have rebelled ever since then. And it's that sin of rebellion that continues to plague Israel until they are carried away. And even when they're brought back under the direction and leadership of men like Jeshua and Zerubbabel and Ezra and Nehemiah, they still have that rebellious spirit within them. And so tonight I want us to think a little bit about the sin of rebellion. What you see with the Israelites is that there are times, there are occasions when they are perfectly willing to follow God and to do what the Lord commanded them to do. When the Lord told them as they prepared to leave Egypt to ask their neighbors, the Egyptians, for the gold and the silver, the gems, well, hey, we'll do that. Is that what you want us to do, Lord? Okay, we'll do that one. When He commands them to leave the land, hey, let's get out of here. There's nobody standing in my way now. So, yeah, we can do that. We're not going to have to put up a fight. There's nothing that... nothing in our way. But now, as soon as something stood in their way, at the beginning with Pharaoh, later the Red Sea and Pharaoh behind, then when they're faced with adversity, they rebel. They don't want to now follow God. when they're there on the verge at Kadesh Barnea. You know, all the way up through there from Mount Sinai up, they're willing to follow, they're willing to march. But now that there is a foe, now that there's possible trouble, well, what do? They rebel. And that type of behavior, while I mentioned a moment ago that it continued throughout the history of Israel, it did not end with the coming of Christ. It did not end with the introduction of the church, the kingdom here in this world. God's perfect plan of having Christ to reign over His body. That did not do away with this sin of rebellion. And their world is still filled with people who are perfectly willing to follow God's commands and to follow God's plan so long as it coincides with what they think ought to be done. When you look over in 1 Samuel, we have here a very specific example that sadly is all too familiar to us. I want to first look in chapter 12 because there's a warning issued here in 1 Samuel 12 to the people and to Saul himself about what could happen if they're not careful. 1 Samuel chapter 12 and verse 13. Now therefore, here is the king whom you have chosen and whom you have desired. And take note, the Lord has set a king over you. If you fear the Lord and serve Him and obey His voice and do not rebel against the commandment of the Lord, then both you and the king who reigns over you will continue following the Lord your God. However, if you do not obey the voice of the Lord, but rebel against the commandment of the Lord, then the hand of the Lord will be against you as it was against your fathers. So here the Lord lays it out there for them. It's your choice. Here's your king that you asked for. And if you will notice, he says there in verse 14, if you fear the Lord. I've given you this king, but he doesn't say if you fear the king and serve him and obey his voice. It's if you fear the Lord and serve him and obey his voice and do not rebel against the commandment of the Lord, then the Lord promised to be with them. And throughout their history, you'll find occasions when they do what the Lord asked them to do. Again, so long as it fit what they wanted to do. And if you turn over to chapter 15, we have a great example of what we're talking about tonight, the sin of rebellion. A very familiar chapter to most all of us here, I'm sure. God has remembered what the Amalekites or the Amalekites, or however you'd like to pronounce their name, God remembered what they did to His people, and now He is going to punish them by the hand of Saul. And so the Lord tells them in verse 3, go up and attack Amalek and utterly destroy all that they have and do not spare them, but kill both man and woman, infant and nursing child, ox and sheep, camel and donkey. Now, that's not hard to understand. What the Lord told them to do. I want you to go. I want you to utterly destroy everything. Now, He could have just said everything, but He didn't even leave it at that. He went on to make sure that they understood. When I say everything, I mean everything. Every person, every animal, everything. So, in verse 4, it seems without hesitation, Saul gathers the people together and numbered them. 200,000 foot soldiers and 10,000 men of Judah. And Saul came to the city of Amalek and lay in wait in the valley. And Saul, notice what Saul now tells the people here, the Kenites. He says, go, depart, get down from among the Amalekites, lest I destroy you with them. For you showed kindness to all the children of Israel when they came up out of Egypt. And so what he says is, I'm going to destroy them. Now, that sounds a lot like what the Lord told him to do. Verse 7, Saul attacked the Amalekites from Havilah all the way to Shur, which is east of Egypt. And he also took Agag, king of the Amalekites, alive and utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword. but he spared Agag. And as Samuel comes, he sees Saul. And when Saul sees Samuel in verse 13, he says, "Blessed are you of the Lord. I have performed the commandment of the Lord." But Samuel said, "What then is this bleating of the sheep in my ears and the lowing of the oxen which I hear?" Saul said, "Oh, they brought them back from the Amalekites, for the people spared the best of the sheep and the oxen to sacrifice to the Lord your God. The rest we have utterly destroyed." Then Samuel said to Saul, "Be quiet, and I will tell you what the Lord said to me last night." And he said to him, "Speak on." So Samuel begins here to rebuke on behalf of the Lord Saul for his disobedience. Of course, Saul has his reasons why they spared the animals, why he did not completely do what the Lord had told him to do. And finally, Samuel, having heard enough of Saul's excuses, says to him in verse 22, "Has the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, to heed than the fat of rams. For rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is as the iniquity and idolatry. Because you've rejected the word of the Lord, he also has rejected you from being king." Somebody might read that chapter and think, well, the Lord's been awful hard on Saul here. I mean, he did most of what God said, almost exactly what God said. But he didn't do it completely. He didn't do everything. And why? Because it didn't seem good to him to do everything the way the Lord had said. And we know it didn't seem good to do everything because he didn't do it. And he had good reasons in his mind why it was okay that he did not utterly destroy all of the animals and why he spared King Agag. I think Tad did a good job this morning explaining a passage that dealt very similar with the offerings and obedience to God, as what Samuel says here. It's not as if God's saying, "I don't want the burnt offerings. I don't want the sacrifices." He commanded those things, but what he wanted was true obedience. And there in verse 23, in a verse that I'd like for us to well remember, rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft. It's interesting. I don't know that there's some great connection, but it's interesting later on in the book when the Lord has departed from Saul. He wants to inquire to find out what he's supposed to do about the Philistines, but the Lord won't answer him. Saul wants to consult a medium, but the problem is the mediums have been expelled from the country. It seems that Saul understood God's thoughts concerning witchcraft and sorcery, and he's expelled all of those who practice those things from the land. But while he might think, you know, those things, yeah, we need to get rid of that, what Samuel tells him is, your rebellion is just as bad. So how does this relate to us? What do we learn about this? Well, this comes up all the time. You have Christians who, like the Israelites, committed themselves as followers of God. Yes, we will follow you. We will lead. We will let you lead. We will keep your commandments. And it seems that there's a willingness to do that so long as that's what I want to do. So long as it makes sense to me. So long as it fits my lifestyle, I'll do those things. But when there's something that comes into conflict with our will, so often it's God's will that's sacrificed. And what that is rebellion. You know, I think we're going to look at some passages in a moment, but just a few examples. And I've heard about this type of situation on a number of occasions where someone is living in adultery. Perhaps it's someone who was a faithful Christian earlier in life, but through circumstances, there was a divorce that took place, there was a remarriage, and maybe they didn't know at the time, but they come to find out later, well, if you're going to faithfully serve the Lord, you can't be married to that man. You can't be married to that woman. To which the response is, well, I'm not leaving them. You know, I'm going to remain in this relationship. And they do so. And so they're not serving God. They're in their adulterous relationship. And then some more time passes. And then you have a spouse. One of the original spouses dies. And so now someone goes to that person and says, well, look, you're no longer guilty of adultery. That first spouse is dead. Now you can serve the Lord. Oh, great. You know, yes, I will serve the Lord now. And there are variations on that story, but that happens a lot more often than I would like to think, where the person has refused to obey the commandment of the Lord because they refuse to change their life. But when things come along and now it's convenient, now I don't really have to do anything, now that the problem has been removed, well, yeah, I'll serve God now. I can go to church every Sunday. I can be nice to people. I can do those things. And so, yeah, I'll be a Christian. I'll be faithful now. But what about that sin of rebellion, which for so many years kept them firm in that relationship that was completely contrary to what God would have them to do? I'm not saying that somebody in that situation can't repent and can't change their circumstance. And if their marriage status has changed, then maybe there's something, but there has to be a repentance of that rebellious spirit. There has to be that brokenness and the realization that God's will has to be done in my life, regardless of what it might cost me. There are other examples of behaviors where people are willing to do, a lot like Saul here, you know, almost everything that the Lord commands, I'm going to be willing to do that. And some of it even at a cost. But maybe just not everything. There's an old song, some of you, as James said, more experienced among us might remember. Maybe you wouldn't, it'd be all right if you didn't. Meatloaf sang it, I would do anything for love. You might remember that because that's repeated again and again, but I won't do that. But there are a lot of people who have that same mentality when it comes to, I'll do anything for God, but I won't do that. You know, there's this one thing that just, I will not do. Well, if you're not willing to do that thing, then you might as well not do any of it, because rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft and you'll be condemned for it. And so whatever the situation is where I'm willing to do a portion of what God said, I'm willing to go real far, maybe just not all the way, well, that's rebellion. And that sin of rebellion will keep us from the kingdom. I'd like with you to turn, like for you to turn with me over to Matthew chapter 18. There's a couple of passages here that where Jesus teaches the need to be truly committed. You have there in Matthew 18, verse 15. Moreover, if your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. If he hears you, you've gained your brother. But if he will not hear, take with you one or two more, that by the mouth of two or three witnesses every word may be established. And if he refuses to hear them, tell it to the church. But if he refuses even to hear the church, let him be to you like a heathen and a tax collector. Surely I say to you, whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. And again, I say to you, if two of you agree on earth concerning anything that they ask, it will be done for them by my Father in heaven. Where there are two or three gathered together in my name, I am there in the midst of them. It's been several years ago. There was a preacher in another state in a forum that I was a part of. He brought up this passage and he said, for years we have looked at what Jesus says there in verse 17, and this brother or sister who will not even hear the church, if he refuses to repent, you let him be to you like a heathen and a tax collector. Now, I'll tell you, for some people, that's pretty easy. For some people, you don't have to tell me, or you wouldn't have to tell many people, hey, you can't hang out with them. Which when Jesus says, let him be to you as a heathen and a tax collector, he understands how they felt about heathen and tax collector. They would not have fellowship with him. They would not keep company with those people. They complained when Jesus, in an attempt to teach them and save their souls, see, they complained when he kept company with them. Well, this brother says, you know, that's the way we've always read this, but how did Jesus deal with the heathen and tax collectors? And of course, he ate with them. That's what they complained about. So really what Jesus is saying here, if you've got a brother or sister who's in sin, you don't shun them. You don't keep your distance. You just wrap your arms around them. You love them. You eat with them. You show them that you care. Now, if that's what it taught, hey, I'd be all on board with that. I tell you, though, that is a lot easier, especially with some people. That's a lot easier to do. I have a brother who lives in Jacksonville, Tennessee, and I would love nothing more than to be able to go and to eat and to keep the company, go fishing and just show him how much I love him. And if that's what Jesus taught. But when you compare this with what Paul teaches in 1 Corinthians 5, using some of the very same language concerning Jesus being with them and the judgment, then we understand what Jesus means. Let him be to you as a heathen and a tax collector. It's not easy, but it's what he tells us to do. And so, am I willing to do everything but this? Am I willing to take the stand that needs to be taken? Not just for my sake, but hopefully in an effort to bring them back to the Lord, to show them how that their sin separates them from God. And therefore, their sin separates them from me. You turn back just a couple of, in my Bible, it's just a page, but a couple of chapters back in Matthew 16. Jesus says here in Matthew 16, verse 24, if anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. For whoever desires to save his life will lose it. Whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what profit is it to a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? Or what will a man give in exchange for his soul? For the Son of Man will come in the glory of his Father with the angels, and then he will reward each according to his works. What do our works report about us? Do our works report about us that we're willing to deny ourselves? Do our works report about us that we're not going to put anybody else in this life ahead of him? Not anybody? Sadly, that there are many who they'll serve God, they'll do what the Lord commands up to a point, but no further. But that's rebellion. Just like Saul did most of what God wanted him to do, we sometimes feel satisfied that we've done a lot of good. Saul did a lot of good that day. He killed a lot of those Amalekites, but he didn't do everything. If you turn with me now to the book of Luke, look at a couple of passages. One very similar to what we just read in Matthew 16, here in Luke chapter 9, in verse 23, he said to them all, if anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross daily, and follow me. And here, Jesus, at least in the New King James, the word daily is added. And I realize some of the manuscripts may not have that in there. But it is a daily process. It's not a one time and we've done it and now we're home free. we have to continue to take up that cross. We have to continue to do the difficult things. The Israelites, at the very beginning, they believed God, they worshiped God. But what did they do the next day? What were they going to do the next day? And so maybe we've been following God. Maybe we've kept His commandments up to this point, but what about tomorrow? We have to continue. And just because we've been faithful to this point doesn't mean that that sin of rebellion can't creep in. We live in a day and a time where it's just rampant. Romans 13 and the command to submit to the governing authorities is just lost on so many people. Now, we'll submit to the governing authorities so long as the laws and the rules they make sense to me. But if not, I don't have to keep that. I don't have to do that. That's nonsense. I was driving the other day over in Bratt, and if you go up North 99, the speed limit's 45. Once you get north of the crossroads, I mean, it is a straight, wide, newly paved road. Speed limit's 45. But you turn on Oakshade Road, which is also a fairly newly paved road, but it's a very narrow road. No markings on the road, no line, speed limit's 55. I tell you, that makes no sense. But that doesn't mean that I'm free to just drive 55 on Highway 99. Now, you say, are you saying I'm going to hell if I speed on Highway 99? It's not what I'm saying. But what I am saying is that thought process doesn't generally stop with speed limits and ordinances and laws of the land. You know, if it doesn't make sense to me, if I don't understand why it's that way, if they'd asked me, I'd have done it a different way. If that's our thought process with government, local, statewide, national, whatever, then what's my thought process with God? Can I really expect to treat Him any different? We're still authority figures. You have children who are disobedient to their parents. They're rebellious. Parent asks them to do something, they don't do it. There's no consequence. They learn that growing up, and then they treat everybody that's in a position of authority over them the same way, and ultimately they treat God that way. And so we need to recognize that this taking up our cross daily and following Christ, that is a complete surrender. And I know we read this passage, I mention this passage from time to time, but I don't know that it's one that we could ever talk about enough. And it's what Paul says that he did in Galatians chapter 2. And I really think what Paul is describing here in Galatians 2 is what Jesus calls us to do when he says, take up your cross and follow me. Now, I do think when Paul says, I've been crucified with Christ, I think he is pointing to the death of that old man when he died with Christ and was buried with him in baptism. But he, in Colossians, will talk about being raised to walk. And so Paul understands this is not a one-and-done type thing. But Galatians 2, verse 20, again, notice the mindset and the giving up of my will and accepting God's will in our life. I've been crucified with Christ. That means I'm dead. And he says that. It's no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. But you're still walking around, Paul. You're still alive. And Paul says, yeah. But the life that I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God, who loved me and gave himself for me. And Paul had completely given over his will to do the will of God. Was it easy? No. But was it needful? Was it necessary? Absolutely. And if we're going to serve God, if we're going to truly serve him faithfully all our days, then we have to be 100% committed right now. Whatever he calls me to do, I'm going to do it. A lot of people at this point will bring up, well, what if, and what if this, and what if that? What if? If I am convinced, if that's what the Lord wants me to do, then I'm going to do it. And if we're not committed to that, if we're not totally committed to doing the Lord's will, then we've got that sin of rebellion in our heart. And just as it kept the children of Israel out of the promised land, it will certainly keep us out of that eternal home that Christ has died to prepare for us. We're going to sing the song of invitation. All things are ready. They're ready not because we have water in the baptistry. They're not ready because we're gathered here tonight and we're now going to offer an invitation. All things are ready because Jesus was intent on doing the will of His Father. Jesus was not rebellious when what the Lord's will was difficult. And even as He prayed in agony, sweating as great drops of blood in the Garden of Gethsemane, "If it be Thy will, let this cup pass from me," He was still willing to do whatever the Lord called Him to do. And so because of His willingness to die on the cross, to shed that blood as a sacrifice for our sins, we can be forgiven. And all things are now ready. If you're subject to the invitation, would you please come and respond?
All things are ready.